surprised at how giddy I became with such simple things. I knew that I'd be happier if I made a mindful effort to thwart my underbuying impulse and instead work to buy what I needed. For instance, I ended my just-in-time policy for restocking toilet paper. One of my secrets of adulthood is keep a roll of toilet paper tucked away someplace, so we never actually ran out, but we teetered on the dreary brink. I mentioned this problem to Jamie. "We're like Walmart," he said. "We keep all our capital working for us instead of sitting on a lot of inventory." "Well," I said, "now we're going to invest in some redundant supply." Moderation is pleasant to the wise, but toilet paper was something I wanted to keep on hand. This kind of little annoyance puts a surprisingly big drag on happiness. As Samuel Johnson remarked, "To live in perpetual want of little things is a state not indeed of torture, but of constant vexation." Another thing that I really needed was white t-shirts, because I wear them practically every day. I enjoy shopping only when I'm with my mother, so I waited to buy my t-shirts until my mother was visiting from Kansas City. I wanted t-shirts that were soft, stretchy, not too thin, V-necked and long-sleeved, and to me, tracking down and buying such shirts seemed like an overwhelming challenge. My mother was undaunted. "We'll go to Bloomingdale's," she decided. Though I felt dazed the minute I entered the store, my mother walked purposely from one area to the next. As she began her systematic inspection, I trailed along behind her and carried the shirts she'd pulled out. After she'd considered every white shirt on the floor, I tried on, conservative estimate, 20 shirts. I bought 8. My mother had joined with zeal my quest for the perfect white t-shirt, but when she saw the stack of monochrome cotton at the cash register, she asked, "Are you sure you don't want any other colors or styles? This is a lot of white shirts." "Well," I hesitated, "did I really want this many white shirts?" Then I remembered a study showing that people think they like variety more than they do. When asked to pick a menu of snacks for the upcoming weeks, they picked a variety. But if they chose week to week what to eat, they picked their favorite snack over and over. In a store, it seemed like a good idea to have a variety of colors. But I knew from experience that when I stood in front of my closet, I always wanted to pull out the same things: white V-neck t-shirt, black yoga pants or jeans, and running shoes. Buy needful things. "Yes, I just want white," I said firmly. Inspired by my shirt success, I replaced our leaky blender. I bought a personalized return address stamp. I'd realized that the paradoxical consequence of being an underbuyer was that I had to shop more often, while buying extras meant fewer trips to the cash register. I bought batteries, band-aids, light bulbs, diapers, things I knew we would need eventually. I finally ordered business cards, which I'd been putting off for years. I was inspired when, at a meeting, someone handed me the best-looking business card I'd ever seen. I got all the information so I could order a copycat version for myself. My decision-making process for ordering a business card showed me that not only was I an underbuyer, I was also a satisficer, as opposed to a maximizer. Satisficers, yes, satisficers, are those who make a decision or take action once their criteria are met. That doesn't mean they'll settle for mediocrity. Their criteria can be very high, but as soon as they find the hotel, the pasta sauce, or the business card that has the qualities they want, they're satisfied. Maximizers want to make the optimal decision. Even if they see a bicycle or a backpack that meets their requirements, they can't make a decision until after they've examined every option so they can make the best possible choice. Studies suggest that satisficers tend to be happier than maximizers. Maximizers spend a lot more time and energy to reach a decision, and they're often anxious about whether they did in fact make the best choice. As a shopper, my mother is a good example of what I'd call a happy limited maximizer. In certain distinct categories, she's a maximizer, and she loves the very process of investigating every possibility. Now that Eliza and Eleanor were going to be flower girls in my sister's wedding, I knew my mother would love nothing more than to examine every possible dress, just for the fun of it. But too often, maximizers find the research process exhausting, yet can't let themselves settle for anything but the best. The difference between the two approaches may be one reason some people find a big city like New York disheartening. If you're a maximizer in New York City, you could spend months surveying your options for bedroom furniture or even wooden hangers. In Kansas City, even the most zealous maximizer can size up the available options pretty quickly. Most people are a mix of both. In almost every category, I was a satisficer, and in fact, I often felt guilty about not doing more research before making decisions. In law school, one friend interviewed with 50 law firms before she decided where she wanted to go as a summer associate. I think I interviewed with 6. We ended up at the same firm. Once I learned to call myself a satisficer, I felt more satisfied with my approach to decision-making. Instead of feeling lazy and unconscientious, I could call myself prudent, a great example of reframing. Spend out. I tend to cling to things, to stuff, to ideas. I reuse razor blades until they're dull. I keep my toothbrushes until they're yellowed and frayed. There is a preppy wabi-sabi to soft, faded khakis and cotton shirts, but it's not nice to be surrounded by things that are worn out or stained or used up. I often found myself saving things, even when it made no sense. Like those white t-shirts I bought. I'd surmounted the challenge of buying them. Then came the challenge of wearing them. When I took them out of the shopping bag and laid them on my shelf, perfectly folded by the sales clerk as I've never learned to do, I could feel myself wanting to save them in their pristine glory. But not wearing clothes is as wasteful as throwing them away. As part of my happiness project, I wanted to stop hoarding, to trust in abundance, so that I could use things up, give things away, throw things away. Not only that, I wanted to stop worrying so much about keeping score and profit and loss. I wanted to spend out. A few years ago, my sister gave me a box of beautiful stationery for my birthday. I loved it, but I'd never used it. When I was mailing some photos to the grandparents, I hesitated to use the new stationery because I was saving it. But to what better use could it be put? Of course I should use those notes. Spend out. I looked through my apartment for ways to spend out. The toughest choices I made concerned things that sort of worked. The camera that had lost its zoom function. The label maker that didn't print properly. I hate waste, but it would probably have cost me as much money and far more time to repair these items as to replace them. And using them in their crippled states weighed me down. I replaced them. My goal wasn't limited to the treatment of my possessions. It also involved my ideas. For example, when I thought of a great subject for a blog post, I often found myself thinking, that's a good idea. Save it for another day. Why? Why delay? I needed to trust that there would be more, that I would have great ideas in the future, and so should use my best stuff now. Pouring out ideas is better for creativity than doling them out by the teaspoon. Spending out also meant not being rigidly efficient. The other night, Jamie and I rented Junebug, an extraordinary movie all about the nature of love and happiness. I was tempted to watch a few of my favorite scenes again after we saw it the first time, but I decided that would be a waste of time. But then I remembered my resolution, which included spending out my time. After all, I know that sometimes the things I do when I'm wasting time turn out to be quite worthwhile. I went to scene selection to rewatch the scene at the church social. The most important meaning of spend out, however, is not to be a scorekeeper, not to stint on love and generosity. This was related to my February resolution, don't expect praise or appreciation. I wanted to stop constantly demanding praise or insisting on getting paid back. Saint Therese of Lisieux wrote, when one loves, one does not calculate. I'm a big calculator, always looking for a return, especially with Jamie. I gave Eleanor a bath last night, so you... I let you take a nap, so you... I had to make the plane reservation, so you... No! Spend out. Don't think about the return. It is by spending oneself, the actress Sarah Bernhardt remarked, that one becomes rich. What's more, one intriguing study showed that Sarah Bernhardt's pronouncement is literally true. People who give money to charity end up wealthier than those who don't give to charity. After doing complex number crunching to control for different variables, a researcher concluded that charitable giving isn't just correlated with higher income, it actually causes higher income. Some explanations for this surprising effect include the brain stimulation caused by charitable activity and also the fact that those who are seen behaving charitably are likely to be elevated to leadership positions. It's certainly true in my household that spending out creates a wealth of love and tenderness, while calculation and scorekeeping build resentment. To keep this important yet elusive resolution uppermost in my mind, I maintained a relic. In one of my last visits to my grandmother before she died, I picked up the My Sin perfume that had been sitting on her bureau for as long as I could remember. The bottle was still in its box, and when I opened it, I saw that it was still full to the top. I didn't ask her about it, but I'm sure someone, many years ago, gave her that bottle of perfume, and she was saving it. For what? After she died, I took the box home with me, and I keep it in my office to remind me to spend out. I posted on my blog about that bottle of perfume, and several readers responded with their own experiences of spending out. Your story reminds me of some pretty linen napkins that I found in my mother's house after she died. I lived in that house for a long time and never even saw those napkins. She was apparently saving them. For what? I have no idea. But she never did get to use them. Now they're mine, and I'm sure as heck going to use them the next time I have someone over for dinner, which, come to think of it, is tomorrow night. Life is too short to save your good china or your good lingerie or your good anything for later, because truly, later may never come. I can't believe there is someone else out there that does this too. I have struggled with this for years. I realized it was contributing to my mental dismalness. I thought I should be keeping some of my new, better stuff just in case of, so pessimistic here, bad days ahead. Sadly, I found that I have even pushed it over on my own daughter, i.e., don't use up all the battery power in your toys. I think that's when I realized it. Now I'm on the track to using it up all today, because who knows about tomorrow. I learned this lesson painfully. When I was a child, my grandparents gave me a very elaborate box of art supplies for Hanukkah. Really beautiful paints, brushes, chalks, paper, etc. I kept saving it, planning to use it only once I was a better artist, because I didn't want to waste any of these treasures. As a kid, you really do see yourself getting more skillful, so this wasn't totally crazy. One day, I happened to look for the box and couldn't find it. My mother said, "Oh, you never touched that art set, so I figured you weren't interested." She had taken it to the thrift shop. I was crushed, but I've never forgotten it. Sometimes later becomes never. Give something up. Sometimes, something that makes you happy also makes you unhappy, like smoking cigarettes, having one more cupcake, staying up until 3 o'clock a.m. to watch The Godfather for the fifth time, and, surely one of the most popular happy-unhappy activities, shopping. Many people get a big kick out of buying things, but once they're home, cash register happiness changes to remorse and guilt. Although I'm generally an underbuyer, every once in a while I do switch to a buy setting. A friend once described this as my drive-by shopping mode. This happened when we moved to our current apartment. For the first time, I had my own little home office, and I went nuts outfitting it. I bought a complicated desk chair, a wooden desktop organizer, special boxes to hold my supplies, all kinds of mailing envelopes and elaborate notebooks and sticky pads, fancy rubber bands printed with patterns, a headset for my phone, an extra battery for my laptop, anything I could think of. It was after I bought a magnetic paperclip holder shaped like a little chirping bird that I started to feel guilty about the amount of stuff I was accumulating. I resolved to give something up. I had everything I really needed, and I made a rule for myself. No more purchases for the office. I cut that category of spending out altogether, and it felt good to say no to myself and to stop buying. Enough. When I wrote a blog post about my experience of resolving to give something up, someone wrote to say, "It's better to focus on the positive. Instead of telling yourself no, or never, or don't, focus on what you want and be moderate. Otherwise, you're just setting yourself up to backslide and fail." That's a good point to keep in mind, but I don't agree that it's always true. First of all, when I'm trying to give something up, I find it easier to give it up entirely than to try to indulge moderately. Also, sometimes it feels good to say, I'm going to stop. No more. Maybe tomorrow, but not today. Happiness experts point out that merely making and sticking to a decision is a source of happiness because it gives you a feeling of control, of efficacy, of responsibility. At times of financial stress in particular, taking control of your finances, even symbolically, can boost your mood because you're taking steps to control and improve your situation. At a time when I was feeling anxious about the expenditures related to our new apartment, it was comforting to refuse to spend any more in one particular area. This wasn't really economically rational, because buying one kitchen chair dwarfed my savings on a stapler, but it was psychologically effective, nevertheless. I asked blog readers if anyone had ever boosted his or her happiness by giving up a category of purchases entirely, and many people posted about their own forfeits. Grabbing a Cinnabon in airports, so expensive and so unhealthy. Owning a car. Lottery tickets. Printed periodicals, now I read newspapers and magazines online only. And trading up to get the latest cell phone. When I moved into my current place, about a year and a half ago, I didn't subscribe to cable TV, which meant I had no broadcast TV at all. Since then, TV watching has been Netflix or nothing. It was a choice based on frugality that had a philosophical savor to it. When that level of frugality is no longer necessary to reach my financial goals, I'll reevaluate. But dollars to donuts, even if I resubscribe to cable, I'll still watch less than I did before. Bottled water? No sugar-based snacks at work? Eating out at any time other than Friday, Saturday nights? As a result, the wife and I are losing weight and saving money. No more buying things on eBay. At first it was fun, but then it started to get out of hand. I was ending up with things I didn't really need or want because I loved looking around and making discoveries. It was showing up in my wallet, however. One day I clicked on the site and said to myself, no more. It has really been a relief. Plus, I hadn't realized what an amount of time it was using. Readers also mentioned that they'd been happy to give up things unrelated to spending, such as sleeping until noon on the weekends, checking TMZ.com, eating cereal, and sunbathing. I have a story to tell about feeling happier as a result of giving up something. About 5 years ago, I got a job at a local animal shelter. At the time I began my job, I was a big-time carnivore. However, the longer I worked at the shelter, the more I became uncomfortable with the fact that I was eating some animals at the same time I was saving others. I was being irrational. More importantly, I was also being inhumane. A few of my coworkers were vegans, and I soon joined them. I don't eat meat, dairy products, or eggs. I don't buy clothing made of fur, leather, or wool. I've read Gary Taubes' book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, so I'm not certain whether my diet produces any dramatic benefits in my health. But I do know that my behavior is now more consistent with my moral code. I also know that no matter what kind of day I had, at the very least, I can go to bed knowing that I did not contribute to the exploitation of sentient creatures. I gave up processed sugar. This has been difficult, but not exactly for the reasons I thought it would be. I am a candy addict. I thought I would miss my Skittles and Starbursts and Lifesavers and Twizzlers and rainbow gumballs like crazy. But because I really went cold turkey and told people about my plan, it has not been so tough. No negotiations, no little bits here and there, just no. I'm still getting used to taking my coffee black, though. Such a change from 5 to 7 Splendas. 34 days later, is it worth it? Yes. This is my one and only life. Obviously, people's choices will be different. Just because I'm happier when I don't buy office equipment doesn't mean that other people should stop buying highlighters. But although the resolution to give something up may sound severe and Spartan, it can feel good to choose to forego something. Samuel Butler wrote, happiness and misery consist in a progression towards better or worse. It does not matter how high up or low down you are. It depends not on this, but on the direction in which you are tending. This seems the key to understanding the relationship between money and happiness. However, because people differ wildly from one another in how they respond to money and the things it can purchase, it's practically impossible to make generalizations. Take my blender. When I replaced our leaky blender, I splurged and bought a very expensive, very powerful blender. For me, because I make smoothies every day, this blender is a daily joy. For a person who never cooks, a fancy blender would be nothing but a means of conspicuous consumption. He'd never give it another thought after buying it, and it wouldn't add to his happiness. If money is to enhance your happiness, it must be used to support aspects of life that themselves bring happiness to you. Money. It's a good servant, but a bad master. It was during this month, in the midst of trying to understand the mysteries of money, that I had a bout of happiness project despair. It had been a horrible Saturday morning. We were all in bad moods. Jamie had let me sleep late, which was nice, but my morning went downhill from the moment I emerged from the bedroom. After I'd had a cup of coffee, he asked if he could go to the gym, and I said yes, but I was simmering with resentment. Once he left, Eliza and Eleanor played nicely together for about 5 minutes, then started poking, teasing, and yelling. At the Nader, Eleanor was throwing a tantrum, lying on the floor, kicking her feet, beating her fists against the floor, and shrieking. Why? Eliza looked at me. Eliza joined in sobbing. It's not my fault. I hate it when she cries. All my happiness project resolutions started flashing through my mind, but I didn't want to sing in the morning, or take time to be silly, or give proofs of love. I wanted someone to worry about making me feel better. I'd been trying so hard to keep my resolutions, but was it working? No. Nothing about me had changed. But if I abandoned my resolutions, what were my options? I could sit on the floor and start howling. I could walk away from the girls, get into bed, and read a book. But would I be happier if I did? No. Minutes passed, and none of us seemed able to move. I was furious at Jamie for being at the gym. Eleanor kept crying. Eliza kept crying. I stood in the doorway. This is ridiculous, I yelled. Both of you, stop it. You're crying about nothing. Eleanor cried harder. Eliza cried harder. I fought back the urge to smack each of them. Don't yell at me, Eliza wailed. It's not my fault. Eleanor rotated her body on the floor so she could start kicking the walls instead. I had to do something. It took every ounce of moral strength that I possessed to say, crying makes a person thirsty. I'm going to get you each a glass of water. Both girls love to drink water. I went to the kitchen. First, I opened a can of Diet Coke for myself. Then I poured 2 glasses of water. I took a deep breath and tried to sound cheerful. Who's thirsty? Does anyone want some almonds? I crossed my fingers. Eliza and Eleanor straggled into the kitchen, sniffling melodramatically. They each took a drink of water and a few almonds. Then they sat down and drank more water and ate more almonds. Suddenly, the mood lightened a bit. Hey, I said to Eliza, did you eat much breakfast? No, she said. We started playing with the My Little Ponies. Note to self, I said. Don't let you two get too hungry. I started laughing hysterically, and the girls stared at me as they munched away. That bad moment passed, but the rest of the day was hardly better. Eliza and Eleanor kept squabbling. Jamie and I kept bickering. Everybody was getting on my nerves. That afternoon, while I was trying to prod the girls into tidying up the dozens of crayons that they'd scattered over the kitchen floor, I suddenly noticed that Jamie had vanished. Jamie, I yelled a few times, then went to hunt him down. I was enraged to find him fast asleep in the flying Superman position on our bed. My scorekeeping kept running through my head. I got to sleep late. He got to go to the gym. Why did he get to take a nap, too? What was I going to get in return? Remember, my conscience whispered, no calculation. I ignored it. My happiness project was making me feel worse, not better. I was acutely aware of all the mistakes I was making and the steps I could be taking, but I just couldn't. I wouldn't. To hell with the resolutions. Why was I even bothering with the resolutions? Many of them were actually directed at making other people happier, and no one appreciated my efforts. No one even noticed. I was particularly mad at Jamie. Did he ask me about my research? Did he utter one word of gratitude for the clean closets, the sweet emails, the decline in nagging? Nope. I could hear the girls in the next room. Mine! No, mine! Well, I was playing with it. Don't push. You hurt my arm. And so on. I stormed into Jamie. Get up! Are you just going to listen to that? Do you enjoy hearing that shrieking and hitting? Jamie rolled over and rubbed his eyes. He fixed me with a look that I interpreted to mean, I'm waiting for you to get yourself under control. Don't just lie there. This is your problem, too, I snapped at him. What is? Listen to Eliza and Eleanor. They've been like this all day. You fix it. I'm sorry I'm not being helpful, he said. I just don't know exactly what to do. So you figured you'd wait for me to deal with it? Of course, he said, smiling. He held out his arms to me. I knew from my February research that this was a repair attempt. Are you giving me a gold star? I lay down next to him on the bed. Yes, he said. The yelling from the girls got louder, then ominously quiet. Ah, the happy sounds of home. We both started laughing. Are we in harmony, he asked, even if I am a slacker, napping husband? I guess, I said. I put my head against his chest. I'll tell you what, let's go to the park. We need to get outdoors. He sat up and yelled, Put your shoes on, you two. We're going to the park. This announcement was greeted with wails of indignation. Don't want to put on shoes. I don't want to go to the park. Well, you're going to. I'll help you both get ready. It was one of those days, and there would be others. A happiness project was no magic charm. But that night, I did manage to keep one resolution. Go to sleep earlier. And in the morning, things looked a little better. Although it took several days before my bad mood lifted completely, at least I was ready to tackle my resolutions again. Chapter 8, August. Contemplate the heavens. Eternity. Read memoirs of catastrophe. Keep a gratitude notebook. Imitate a spiritual master. I'd become firmly convinced that money could help buy happiness. Still, there was something unappealing about thinking about money too much. It made me feel grasping and small-minded. By the end of July, I was relieved to turn from the worldly subject of money to the spiritual realm. I figured August was a particularly good time to focus on eternal things because we'd be taking our family vacation. Stepping out of my usual routine would allow me to see more clearly the transcendent values that underlay everyday life. First, however, I had to figure out exactly what I wanted to achieve in my contemplation of eternity. My upbringing wasn't religious. As a child, I went to Sunday school when I visited my grandparents in Nebraska, and we celebrated Christmas and Easter with lots of decorations, but that was the extent of it. Then I married Jamie, who is Jewish. His upbringing had been about as religious as mine, and since we now had a mixed household, we had even less religion at home. We celebrated Christian holidays with my parents and Jewish holidays with his parents, which made both sets of parents very happy because they never had to switch off, and observed all holiday traditions in a very secular, Hallmarky way. Nevertheless, I've always been interested in learning about religion and in the experiences of devout people. I describe myself as a reverent agnostic. I'm attracted to belief, and through my reading, I enter into the spirit of belief. Also, although I'd never thought of myself as particularly spiritual, I came to see that spiritual states, such as elevation, awe, gratitude, mindfulness, and contemplation of death, are essential to happiness. When I mentioned to Jamie that my focus for August was eternity, he asked suspiciously, You're not going to engage in a lot of morbid activities, are you? That actually sounded intriguing. I don't think so, I answered. Like what? I have no idea, he said, but contemplating eternity sounds like something that might get tiresome for the rest of the family. No, I assured him. No skulls on the coffee table, I promise. But I had to find some way to steer my mind toward the transcendent and the timeless, away from the immediate and the shallow. I wanted to cultivate a contented and thankful spirit. I wanted to appreciate the glories of the present moment and my ordinary life. I wanted to put the happiness of others before my own happiness. Too often, these eternal values got lost in the hubbub of everyday routines and selfish concerns. Will focusing on spiritual matters make you happier? According to the research, yes. Studies show that spiritual people are relatively happier. They're more mentally and physically healthy, deal better with stress, have better marriages, and live longer. In AD 524, while in prison awaiting execution, the philosopher Boethius wrote, contemplate the extent and stability of the heavens, and then at last cease to admire worthless things. The challenges to my serenity were insignificant compared to execution, of course, but I wanted to cultivate the same sense of perspective so I could remain unruffled by petty annoyances and setbacks. I wanted to strengthen myself so I'd have the fortitude to face the worst if, that is, when, I had to. To achieve this, the great religious and philosophic minds urge us to think about death. As the Buddha counseled, of all mindfulness meditations, that on death is supreme. But I wasn't sure how to go about meditating on death. Medieval monks kept images of skeletons in their cells as memento mori. 16th century Vanitas artists painted still lifes that included symbols of the brevity of life and the certainty of death, like guttering candles, hourglasses, rotten fruit, and bubbles. What could I do to achieve the heightened awareness that death and catastrophe bring without putting that skull on the coffee table? I'd hit on a memento mori that suited me. I'd read memoirs by people facing death. I went to the library and checked out an enormous stack of books. I started by collecting accounts by people grappling with serious illness and death, but then I broadened my search to include any kind of catastrophe, divorce, paralysis, addiction, and all the rest. I hoped that it would be possible for me to benefit from the knowledge that these people had won with so much pain, without undergoing the same ordeals. There are some kinds of profound wisdom that I hope never to gain from my own experience. August was a month of sunshine and vacation, which, because it made such a stark contrast to the dark confidences of these books, was probably the best backdrop. The reassurance of being with my family made it easier to experience vicariously so much unhappiness and loss. As we were packing for a trip to the beach, Jamie glanced at a few of the books I'd stuffed into our battered duffel bag. "Is this really what you want to be reading while we're away?" he said doubtfully as he scanned the book jackets. "Stan Mack on cancer, Jean O'Kelly on brain tumors, and Martha Beck on having a baby with Down syndrome?" I know, it seems like it would be incredibly depressing to read these books, but it's not. It's sad, but it's also, well, I hate to say uplifting, but they are uplifting. "Okay," he shrugged, "whatever. I'm taking A Bright Shining Lie and Middlemarch." By the end of our trip, I'd finished every book I'd packed. I didn't agree with Tolstoy's observation that happy families are all alike, but perhaps it was true that every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Although many of these memoirs described a similar circumstance, grappling with a life-threatening condition, each was memorable for its story of unique suffering. As a consequence of reading these accounts, I found myself with a greatly heightened appreciation for my ordinary existence. Everyday life seems so permanent and unshakable, but, as I was reminded by these writers, it can be destroyed by a single phone call. One memoir after another started with a recitation of the specific moment when a person's familiar life ended forever. Gilda Radner wrote, "On October 21st, 1986, I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. The call comes at 7 o'clock p.m. The tumor is malignant and inoperable." Cornelius Ryan recalled July 23rd, 1970. "On this soft morning, I think I must begin to acknowledge the distinct possibility that I am dying. The diagnosis changes everything." Reading these accounts also gave me a new and intense appreciation for my obedient body, for the simple ability to eat or walk or even pee in the usual fashion. Being on vacation pulled me off my usual eating routine, and I found myself indulging in potato chips, milkshakes, grilled cheese sandwiches, and other treats that I wouldn't ordinarily eat. One morning I felt dejected because I'd gained a few pounds. But having just finished an account by a prostate cancer survivor made me feel far more kindly to my own body. Instead of feeling perpetually dissatisfied with my weight, I should delight in feeling vital, healthy, pain-free, fear-free. A common theme in religion and philosophy, as well as in catastrophe memoirs, is the admonition to live fully and thankfully in the present. So often, it's only after some calamity strikes that we appreciate what we had. There are times in the lives of most of us, observed William Edward Hartpole Lecky, when we would have given all the world to be as we were but yesterday, though that yesterday had passed over us, unappreciated and unenjoyed. As I became more aware of the preciousness of ordinary life, I was overwhelmed by the desire to capture the floods of moments that passed practically unnoticed. I never used to think much about the past, but having children has made me much more wistful about the passage of time. Today, I'm pushing Eleanor in a stroller. One day, she'll be pushing me in a wheelchair. Will I then remember my present life? I couldn't get a line from Horace out of my head. The years as they pass plunder us of one thing after another. I decided to start a one-sentence journal. I knew I couldn't write lyrical prose for 45 minutes each morning in a beautiful notebook, and my handwriting is so bad that I wouldn't be able to read it afterward if I did, but I could manage to type one or two sentences into my computer each night. This journal became a place to record the fleeting moments that make life sweet, but that so easily vanish from memory. It also helped me amplify the effect of happy experiences by giving me an opportunity to observe the third and fourth prongs of the four stages of happiness by expressing and recalling my feelings. Even after this summer had faded into the past, I'd have a way to remind myself of the unmemorable but lovely moments. The night Jamie invented a new kind of pie, or Eliza's first trip alone to the grocery store. I can't imagine forgetting the time when Eleanor pointed to her spaghetti and said politely, "Mo pajamas, please," when she meant Parmesan. But I will. On our last day at the beach, when we were packed up and ready to leave, Jamie and I sat reading the newspaper as we all waited for the ferry. Eleanor wandered off to practice her stair climbing on a short set of three stairs, so I went to help her climb up and down, up and down. I considered going to get a section of the paper to read as I stood with her, and then I realized, this is it. This was my precious, fleeting time with Eleanor as a little girl, so adorable and cheery and persistent as she went up and down those wooden stairs. The sun was shining. The flowers were blooming. She looked so darling in her pink summer dress. Why would I want to distract myself from the moment by reading the paper? She'd already grown so much. We'd never have a tiny baby again. I'd had this thought before, but suddenly I grasped that this was my third splendid truth. The days are long, but the years are short. It sounds like something from a fortune cookie, but it's true. Each day, each phase of life seems long, but the years pass so quickly. I wanted to appreciate the present time, the seasons, this time of life. With Eliza, so much had already passed away. The Wiggles, Pat the Bunny, the make-believe games we used to play. One day, and that day wasn't too far away, I'd think back on Eleanor's babyhood with longing. This moment of preemptive nostalgia was intense and bittersweet. From that moment of illumination, I've had a heightened awareness of the inevitability of loss and death that has never left me. I made a note of this moment in my one-sentence journal, and now I can hang on to it forever. All packed up to go home, waiting for the ferry, Eleanor had as much fun climbing the beach stairs as anything we did all summer. Up and down, up and down. Heartbreakingly adorable in her white hat that Jamie bought. Clutching her favorite toothbrush, of course. But everything changes, everything passes. Sometimes I do cheat and write more than one sentence. When I introduced the idea of the one-sentence journal on my blog, I was surprised by the enthusiastic response. Clearly, a lot of people suffer from the same thwarted journal-keeping impulse that I do. Like me, they find the prospect of keeping a journal enticing, but intimidating. The idea of keeping a limited journal, to enjoy the satisfaction of keeping a record of experiences or thoughts, but without the guilt or burden of writing at length, struck a chord. Several people shared their own versions of one-sentence journals. One reader kept a journal that he planned to give to his three children. He travels a lot for work, so he keeps a small notebook in his briefcase, and every time he gets on a plane, and only while passengers are boarding. He fills a few pages about the latest goings-on in their family. I think this is a particularly brilliant solution because it transforms wasted time, boarding time, into an enjoyable, creative, and productive period. Another reader wrote to say that, after seeing an interview with the writer Elizabeth Gilbert on Oprah, she'd been inspired to imitate Gilbert's practice of keeping a happiness journal in which she writes down the happiest moment of every day. Another reader, an entrepreneur, keeps a work journal in which he notes any important work-related events, problems, or discoveries. He reported that it was an invaluable resource because whenever he wants to remember how he handled a particular situation, his journal prompts his memory of how he handled it and what he learned. I work alone, and if I didn't have a work journal, I'd probably keep making the same stupid mistakes over and over. Also, it gives me a feeling of progress by reminding me how far I've come since I started my company. Along with keeping the one-sentence journal, the catastrophe memoir spurred me to take another, less pleasant kind of action. I realized that Jamie and I needed to get our affairs in order. All the memoirs emphasized how horrible it was to deal with cold logistics at a time of shock and grief. "You know," I said to Jamie, "we really need to update our wills." "Okay, let's do it," he answered. "We've been saying that we should for years, and we really need to." "Okay. We're never going to feel like doing it, so we just have to decide to do it." "Yes, you're right," he said. "I'm agreeing with you. Let's get something on the calendar." And we did. Zoinks, there's nothing like seeing the words last will and testament in lawyerly, old-fashioned, typewriter-style courier font to act as a memento mori. And although it sounds supremely unromantic, rarely have I felt such love for Jamie as I did in that lawyer's office. I was so grateful for the fact that he was alive and strong and that the wills seemed like play documents that would never matter. With our wedding anniversary approaching on September 4th, it occurred to me that a slightly grim way to mark the occasion would be to use our anniversary as an annual prompt to review our situation. Were our wills up to date? Did Jamie and I both have access to the financial information that the other person routinely handled? I knew offhand that Jamie had no idea where I kept our tax or insurance information or the girls' birth certificates. I probably should mention that to him. Repeating this Be Prepared Day review annually on our anniversary would keep it from seeming morbid. Instead, it would be an ordinary expression of family responsibility. Along the same lines, one night, as I lay reading in bed after Jamie had fallen asleep, I finished Joan Didion's The Year of Magical Thinking, about the first year after her husband's death. As I closed the book, I was overwhelmed with thankfulness at the fact that Jamie, snoozing gently beside me, was safe, for now. Why did I get so irritated when he waited for me to change Eleanor's diaper? Why did I keep complaining about his failure to return my emails? Let it go. I felt a bit guilty about my reaction to these memoirs of catastrophe. Was it wrong to feel reassured by reading about these sorrowful events? Viewed one way, there was a ghoulish quality to this downward comparison, a Schadenfreude-ish exploitation, however benign, of other people's anguish. But the feeling of happy relief that came from recognizing my good fortune, for the moment, was something most of these writers had sought to create. Over and over, they emphasized the importance of cherishing health and appreciating ordinary life. Other themes? Keep up with your doctor's appointments. Don't ignore big changes in your body. Make sure you have health insurance. That said, I don't think these memoirs would cheer me if I'd had more brushes with serious illness. I don't think I'd be able to stand reading them. Jamie, for one, would never read these books. He's had too many unpleasant experiences in hospitals to want to visit voluntarily, even through the lives of other people. Reading catastrophe memoirs made me extremely grateful for the fact that I wasn't experiencing a catastrophe. Research shows that because we measure ourselves relative to others, our happiness is influenced by whether we compare ourselves to people who are better or worse off. In one study, people's sense of life satisfaction changed dramatically depending on whether they completed sentences starting, "I'm glad I'm not," or instead, "I wish I was." In the days after September 11th, 2001, the emotion people most commonly experienced after compassion was gratitude. Gratitude is important to happiness. Studies show that consistently grateful people are happier and more satisfied with their lives. They even feel more physically healthy and spend more time exercising. Gratitude brings freedom from envy, because when you're grateful for what you have, you're not consumed with wanting something different or something more. That, in turn, makes it easier to live within your means and also to be generous to others. Gratitude fosters forbearance. It's harder to feel disappointed with someone when you're feeling grateful toward him or her. Gratitude also connects you to the natural world, because one of the easiest things to feel grateful for is the beauty of nature. But I find it hard to stay in a grateful frame of mind. I take things for granted. I forget what other people have done for me. I have high expectations. To cure this, following the advice repeated by many happiness experts, I started a gratitude notebook. Each day, I noted three things for which I was grateful. Usually, I logged my gratitude entries at the same time that I made my daily notes in my one-sentence journal. These various tasks were making me happier, but they were also keeping me busier. After keeping the notebook for a week, I noticed something. I never thought to mention some of the most important bases of my happiness. I took for granted that I lived in a stable, democratic society, that I could always count on my parents' love, support, and general lack of craziness, the fact that I loved my work, the health of my children, the convenience of living right around the corner from my in-laws, not to mention the fact that I loved living right around the corner from my in-laws, a situation that many people might consider undesirable. I loved living in an apartment instead of a house. No yard work, no shoveling snow, no going outside to get the newspaper in the morning, no carrying out the trash. I was grateful that I would never again have to study for an exam or a standardized test. I tried to push myself to appreciate better the fundamental elements of my life, as well as the problems that I didn't have. For example, one morning after Jamie had one of his regular appointments with his liver doctor, he still hadn't called me by lunchtime. Finally, I called him. So what did the doctor say? No change, he said absentmindedly. What does that mean, no change? Well, nothing has changed. Usually I wouldn't have given this report much thought, but pondering gratitude and reading catastrophe memoirs made me realize, what a happy day. No news is fantastic news. It got a starred entry in my gratitude notebook. I was mindful of being grateful, too, for all the bad fortune that had narrowly passed me by. The near miss on a bridge on an icy road. The time Eliza dreamily walked out into busy traffic before I could stop her. Blog readers recounted their own experiences with their own versions of a happiness notebook. I started a journal of my own a few months ago in the form of a private blog on my own computer. I've spent a lot of time writing in it the things that have bothered me or things in my life that I feel I have botched, but far less time writing down what I have to be grateful for. From my experience, a gratitude journal is a great thing, and it doesn't really need to be a written journal. I tried a written journal for a couple of weeks, but it always felt artificial. Now, every day, as part of my evening meditation, I take some time to really become conscious of the things I am grateful for, and I intensify the emotion. Switching from writing down what I'm grateful for to feeling gratefulness with my heart is a great thing. I learned a lot of that in Thailand, where many people have the habit of visiting temples and making merit. The first couple of times I went with them, I always asked them what to do and how to behave, and they answered, "You shall just pray with your heart. Make gratitude for everything you experience a real heartfelt emotion." And this really made a big difference for me, from a fake makeup gratitude to a real enriching experience. I went through a terrible period when everything, and I mean everything, in my life went wrong. I had no self-esteem, no confidence in myself. So I started keeping a gratitude journal of things that I was grateful for about myself. I was grateful that I had the discipline to keep exercising, even when I didn't feel like it. I was grateful that I'd given up smoking 2 years ago. I was grateful that I managed to organize a birthday party for my father. Maybe this makes me sound conceited, but keeping that journal helped me not be paralyzed by self-loathing. But after 2 weeks of keeping a gratitude notebook, I realized that although gratitude boosts happiness, My gratitude notebook wasn't having that effect anymore. It had started to feel forced and affected, and instead of putting me in a grateful frame of mind, it made me annoyed. Later, I read a study that suggested I might have had better luck with my gratitude notebook if I had kept it twice a week instead of every day. Expressing gratitude less often seemed to keep it more meaningful. But by then, I'd soured on the task. I gave it up. Because my gratitude notebook didn't work, I had to find other ways to cultivate gratitude. I tied the action of typing my password into my computer to a moment of gratitude. While I waited for my computer to wake from its slumber, I thought grateful thoughts. This gratitude meditation had the same effect as a gratitude notebook, but somehow it didn't bug me. Speaking of gratitude meditation, I noticed that if I put the word meditation after any activity, it suddenly seemed much more high-minded and spiritual. When waiting for the bus, I'd tell myself that I was doing bus waiting meditation. In the slow line at the drugstore, I was doing waiting in line meditation. I worked harder to appreciate my ordinary day. This thought arose most naturally when I put the girls to bed. I give Eleanor her sippy cup of milk, then cuddle her in my lap as I rock her to sleep. With Eliza, after Jamie has read to her from Harry Potter for a half an hour, I go snuggle with her for 15 minutes or so. We lie together on her bed, her head on my shoulder, and talk. I tried to appreciate the seasons more, too, to notice, in the midst of concrete and cabs, the color of the sky, the quality of light, the flowers in window boxes. There is indeed, wrote Samuel Johnson, something inexpressibly pleasing in the annual renovation of the world and the new display of the treasures of nature. When I was feeling a distinct lack of gratitude, I tried to cure it by applying the third commandment to act the way I want to feel. Could I turn complaints into thankfulness? When I felt annoyed at having to take Eleanor for her pediatrician's checkup, I told myself, I feel grateful for taking Eleanor to the doctor. The crazy thing is, it worked. How disappointed I'd be if someone else took her. One sleepless morning, I was wide awake at 3 o'clock a.m., and at 4 o'clock, instead of continuing to toss and fume, I told myself, I feel grateful for being awake at 4. I got up, made myself some tea, headed to my dark, quiet office. I lit my orange blossom-scented candle and settled in, knowing that I'd have no interruptions for at least 2 hours. Instead of starting my day feeling frustrated or groggy, I started my day with a feeling of tranquility and accomplishment. Voila! A complaint turned into thankfulness. I'd been spending a lot of time thinking about trying to be more grateful. Then one hot Sunday afternoon, when we were at the pool with Jamie's parents, Eliza said to me, "You know what I was just thinking? I'm in the pool, it's summer, I'm 7 years old, I'm wearing a very cute bathing suit, and my grandmother is asking me if I want anything to eat or drink." By which she meant, life doesn't get better than this. "I know exactly what you mean," I replied. Imitate a spiritual master. One of the most universal spiritual practices is the imitation of a spiritual master as a way to gain understanding and discipline. Christians, for example, study Thomas A. Kempis's Imitation of Christ and ask, "What would Jesus do?" In the secular world, I believe, people often read biographies for spiritual reasons. They want to study and learn from the example of great lives, whether those of Winston Churchill, Abraham Lincoln, Oprah Winfrey, or Warren Buffett. That desire had certainly been one of the reasons why I'd wanted to write biographies myself. Now I decided to study and imitate a new spiritual master. But whom? I asked blog readers what spiritual masters they followed. I greatly admire and have learned a lot from two Zen teachers, although that's not a tradition I practice. Norman Fisher is a person of wisdom, patience, and common sense. My favorite Jewish Zen grandmother, not mine, a woman of great wisdom, eloquence, and candor, is Sylvia Boorstein. And lastly, from my own tradition, Rabbi Charles Kroloff. Vincent van Gogh. I know. How could someone whose legacy involves cutting off his ear be a spiritual mentor? Well, first of all, he didn't really cut off his ear. All you have to do is read his collected letters, Dear Theo, to see how spiritual Van Gogh was, and also to gain inspiration from the life, thoughts, ideas, philosophies, and perseverance of this incredibly talented man, both in the art of painting and also in the art of transcendence, self-empowerment, and self-belief. Charles Darwin, fantastically dedicated to finding out why the natural world looked the way it does. He didn't teach, he showed. His insights were down to long, deep thought and lots of hard work. There are several very good biographies that tell of his unexceptional childhood, his voyage on the Beagle, and how he deliberately chose to earn scientific respectability before he published his world-shaking ideas, backed by huge amounts of examples. It turns out that he was a fairly nice, gentle man, too. Anyone that looks that clearly at the world merits profound respect. Anne Lamott, because she is so honest, and Rabbi Wayne Dosick, even though I'm not Jewish. Two that come to mind, Dr. Andrew Weil, an integrative medicine practitioner and author of many books on the subject. He discusses how people can feel better mentally, physically, and spiritually, and his advice always resonates with me. Another is Natalie Goldberg, author of the popular writing book, Writing Down the Bones. It's a Zen approach to writing, but as she points out, her advice can really apply to many things. To me, what's central to her ideas is self-forgiveness. Actually, I would name the natural world as a spiritual teacher. I don't like the term master. Western culture assumes that only a human can teach spirituality, but in indigenous worldview, any creature, any natural element can be a teacher. We can learn a lot if we learn to listen and observe the natural world. Viktor Frankl. I'm not sure I found a spiritual master, though the poetry and passion of St. Paul have captivated me. My husband finds inspiration in the life of George Orwell. The Dalai Lama. Just seeing a photo of him makes me happy. I never considered imitating him, though. Food for thought. I've picked one and plan to learn more about his fascinating life. He's none other than one of our founding fathers, Ben Franklin. I just read the Wikipedia on him, and it states, a noted polymath, Franklin was a leading author and printer, satirist, political theorist, politician, scientist, inventor, civic activist, statesman, and diplomat. I do remember reading that he did all these things, but to this day, I still can't figure out how. I have to do more research here. Lama Norla Rinpoche, www.kagyu.com, if you're curious to know about him, Tibetan Buddhist like the Dalai Lama. He's been my meditation teacher for over 25 years. The way he teaches is, in a way, the opposite of emulation, though he is very inspiring himself. Funny, I first wrote that as inspiriting. It's more like he's trying to free me to be myself in a deep down positive way. I know this is weird, but I'm going with Dan Savage, the sex advice columnist. He's not so much a spiritual master as an ethical one. And yes, he's a self-admitted potty mouth, but he also advocates honesty, love, and respect. And he's just so quotable, i.e., it's a relationship, not a deposition. As you always say, we don't choose what we like to do, only what we do. And I might not have chosen to elevate Dan to that level, but it's how I genuinely feel about him. Henry David Thoreau sprang immediately to mind. Also, nature. This quote from St. Bernard says it well. You will find something more in woods than in books. Trees and stones will teach you that which you can never learn from masters. Perhaps I should research St. Bernard. Hermann Hesse. While I never thought about him as a spiritual guide, I suppose he is, as I have a collection of all his books, memoirs, and poetry. A quote from him I think you'd find interesting is, "Happiness is a how, not a what. A talent, not an object." Mother Teresa and Gloria Steinem. St. Francis of Assisi has taught me so much about accepting things that might appear as my enemy. Instead of hating, I can reframe a situation. For example, instead of hating mosquitoes, I remind myself how they feed the birds and they too have a purpose. I still dislike them, but I don't hate them like I used to. I love many things about St. Francis and try to emulate him. I work with people who, among other things, are seeking happiness. However, rather than encouraging them to model themselves on someone, a spiritual someone, I ask them to consider several persons of their own gender whom they admire. It could be a figure from history, literature, the cinema, or someone they personally know, a figure from politics, a mentor, a family member, a celebrity. It really makes no difference who it is, as long as these two or three persons are individuals that they admire. Once they have named these people, I ask them to identify specifically those characteristics that they admire, not their looks, please. Then I tell them this, very Jungian, but very useful to know. Whatever it is that they admire in these individuals, and generally the characteristics tend to coincide for all the people they have mentioned,